You're listening to the FQXI podcast. Welcome to the new edition of the podcast from the Foundational Questions Institute. In the last edition, we left you with a cliffhanger, having just started our countdown of the five biggest physics stories of 2013.
Which have very kindly been chosen for us by FQXI member Ian Durham, a quantum physicist at St. Anselm College in New Hampshire. This is actually the second podcast in a trilogy that will run in December and will culminate in Ian crowning this year's Best Physics Advance.
Yes, it's the FQXI List 2, The Desolation of Smog. Not that I'm suggesting that we're unnecessarily padding this countdown out across three podcasts. What would we gain by prolonging these podcasts? It's true we get paid per hour, but I promise you, we would never just needlessly chatter on about things that are totally unrelated to physics simply to fill time and earn ourselves more money.
That's something we would never ever do. Which reminds me, Brendan, how is your cat Puffy doing these days?
Well, very good. Thank you for asking. The anger management classes are going very well.
I'm glad to hear that. Back to the list. If you missed part one of Ian's countdown, then you can visit the podcast page and listen to the first mini-podcast of December to hear what he chose at number five. But now, here's Ian with the physics advance that came in at number four on his list. Let's turn to number four on your list. And I think bearing in mind that, you know, the cosmic neutrinos got bumped off the list, you've put in something here that might, you know, raise a few eyebrows because we're moving away from physics and into mathematics with this one. So you're going to have to justify yourself here.
All right. So I could partly justify myself by saying that I'm also a mathematician. But so my number four was there was a huge and totally out of the blue, unexpected advance in prime number theory this year by a gentleman, Yiteng Zhang, who teaches at the University of New Hampshire, which is right near where I live. So it's kind of near and dear to my heart in that sense. It was fascinating because this is a guy who no one had ever heard of him. And in fact, the rumor had been going around that he had even worked at a Subway restaurant once to make ends meet. And he popped out this result related to something called the twin primes conjecture, which has been around for a long time. And the twin primes conjecture says that there are an infinitely many pairs of primes that are separated by only two. So for instance, the numbers 11 and 13 are both prime, and they're separated by two. And if you go up the list and you list out all the primes, you find these pairs of primes all the way up the list. And so there is this conjecture that you would continue to find these pairs all the way up the list as far as you can go, which is infinity. And that was the twin primes conjecture. But no one had been able to prove it. And as yet, they haven't proved it. But what Yiteng Zhang has done for the first time, because it had never moved past just a pure conjecture, he was able to show that even though the primes themselves get increasingly rarer as you go further out along the number line, you're never going to stop finding pairs of primes that are separated by at most 70 million. So instead of two, he had them 70 million.
70 million, you know, what's the difference?
Well, I'll explain the difference in a minute. Just to mention, because then, this was in May, and then sometime just recently, mid-November, a postdoc at the University of Montreal, which is also not far from here, James Maynard, posted a preprint on archive.org where he got that number down to 600. So from 70 million down to 600. And this has just ignited a firestorm in mathematics. And Terence Tao has launched a program called the Polymath Project where people are collaborating to try and get the number down even further, because obviously the goal is to get it down to two, to
right.
Prove that it's two. But here's the thing. Here's what's important about the fact that it's any number. 70 million, two, 600. I once read a book where someone described prime numbers as being what was left when you took out all the patterns. So you take all the multiples of two, take those out, right? So you know you can count by twos, you can count by threes, you can count by fours. You take all of that stuff out and you're left with these numbers. And they're the numbers that were left, or so had been said by more than one person before. They're what's left when you take all the patterns out, which implied that there was no pattern to them, that they were completely random.
Right. Okay.
And in fact, there's an element of randomness to prime numbers that is relied on in some physical applications of prime numbers. And from the foundational standpoint, what's fascinating about this result is that it implies that there is a pattern. Whether it's 70 million or 2 or 600, there's a pattern there, which means that the prime numbers are not completely random, that there is some kind of pattern. And usually patterns in nature correspond to some kind of symmetry. And in physics, we love symmetry because symmetries tell us an awful lot about how things work. We exploit symmetries all the time. And so I think from a foundational standpoint, from learning why the universe is the way it is and how it's made the way it's made, this, even though it seems like a pure math result, it is absolutely fascinating from a foundational physics standpoint because it removes an element of randomness from the universe. And that, to me, is absolutely fascinating.
Okay, well, I think you've done it. I think you've justified why it's in there at number 4. So I won't argue with you anymore about that.
I'm going to mention Peter Higgs here. So Peter Higgs, of course, won the Nobel Prize this year for the Higgs boson, co-won it with Englert. And he was interviewed and said that in today's academic culture or academic industry, I suppose you could call it, he said he wouldn't get a job. And that he, in fact, it had been a guarded secret at the University of Edinburgh that they had kept him for a while just because they thought, well, you know, if he wins the Nobel Prize, we'll keep him. And if he doesn't, we'll get rid of him kind of thing. Because what he did was really foundational. It took a long time. And he wasn't the kind of person who spit out a lot of papers, which is what's expected nowadays. Yiteng Zheng, who did this result in prime numbers, similarly had not published anything in years. He toiled in solitude for a long time. Now, Higgs didn't toil in solitude, but he worked very hard on a problem for a long time without demonstrable results. And suddenly you have a result. And that's very important in science and mathematics because you never know where that can lead and what it can lead to. One of the other similarities to the whole Higgs boson thing is that somebody also had said that Higgs's work was essentially pure mathematics. I mean, it's applied in the sense that the mathematics applied to physical things that we have now proved are actually exist, but it was still mathematics. And this is a mathematical result that we may not, you know, right now. And actually, we do know that prime numbers have a huge application to a number of areas of physics. But even so, if it isn't quite so obvious now, it may be obvious in the future.
And on the website, I'll put a link to not only some more information about the twin prime conjecture, but also the Guardian article where you can see what Peter Higgs had to say in full, which is, you know, very, very interesting, as you say. And doesn't make you wonder how things would have turned out if I guess he'd been a bit younger or maybe going through the system a bit later.
Well, and it makes you wonder a little bit about where science and physics and math are headed now, because are we going to get fewer of these amazing discoveries because of the way things are set up? Anyway, and he works on consciousness and language and artificial intelligence these days, but he actually was a physicist at one time. And in 1976, he made a prediction. He calculated the energy levels of electrons exposed to a magnetic field in a two-dimensional lattice. And he treated these electrons as this sort of ideal, what are called block electrons, which means they don't interact with one another. And they move in sort of a periodic electric potential that's related to the way the lattice is set up. And what he discovered, ultimately, was that, you know, it's a little bit more complicated than this, but what he discovered was that the pattern that describes the behavior of these electrons in this magnetic field is a fractal pattern and looks a little bit like a butterfly. Actually, it looks a lot like a butterfly. So these were predicted back in 1976, and they grew to be called Hofstadter's butterfly. Well, no one had ever actually seen these things until just this year when two teams actually a team of physicists from Columbia University, the City College of New York, the University of Central Florida, and Tohoku University, and the National Institutes of Material Science in Japan. That was one team. As well as a team that included people at the University of Manchester and Lancaster in the UK and France's National Lab for High Magnetic Fields and also the Institute of Material Science in Madrid. And then there was also a third team that had MIT folks who were teamed up sort of with the same Japanese folks who were teamed up with the Columbia group. So anyway, lots of people. But what they did is they looked at graphene, which of course, graphene won a Nobel Prize recently, 2 years ago, I believe it was.
Yeah.
Graphene is this fascinating structure. It's like if you had a sheet of graphene, it would be like a sheet of graphite that's literally only one atom thick, a single atom thick lattice of carbon atoms. And it has some fascinating properties, including the fact that it's apparently stronger than steel. At any rate, these teams looked at graphene on an extremely flat surface of boron nitride crystal, and were able to visualize whenever the patterns, when they overlaid the graphene over the top of the boron nitride, they could see sometimes the patterns would match up. And by tweaking the relative orientation of these lattices, they could create these, what they would call super lattices with appropriate spacing. It's kind of like just get them to line up just right and it would look like one lattice. And when you take the energy spectrum of this and visualize it, you got essentially Hofstadter's butterfly. And one of the reasons I really, really like this, aside from the fact that it takes a 40-year-old prediction, almost 40-year-old prediction, and suddenly finds it in nature. But one of the other things that I really like about this, and what this relates to how Hofstadter's career has gone, there's a beauty in this. There's a symmetry and a beauty to this. And in fact, Hofstadter gave up on physics to basically study beauty in nature, in a sense. I mean, that's kind of simplifying it a lot. But that's essentially what he did. You almost get the impression that this may have had something to do with it. And here we are, 40 years later, and we've actually finally seen this. And the result, it just demonstrates how beautiful nature can be. I mean, just the mere name Hofstadter's butterfly conjures up so many great things, you know, great ideas in one's head. That's why I had it up here, because I just was fascinated by this. I thought it was a great discovery. You know, aside from the amazing physics that were required to make it happen, it confirmed a 40-year-old prediction, and it had all the elements of a great physics problem. It had symmetry, but then it added that element of beauty to it to show physics isn't just all about crunching numbers. Sometimes it's about seeing patterns, and actually it's all about seeing patterns and visualizing those patterns. Sometimes those patterns can be beautiful.
When we were discussing one of the earlier items on your list, and we talked about this quote by Peter Higgs talking about the academic culture and how he wouldn't get a job today, I'm just reading through this report on the Hofstadter butterfly in Nature, and Hofstadter is talking about how his advisor was very unimpressed when he came up with this in the 1970s. He scornfully called the nesting pattern that this upstart youngster claimed to see mere numerology. He even told me that I would be unable to get a PhD for this kind of work.
Which is fascinating. And it's funny because I've actually, many years ago, studied some old cosmology theories and that were accused of being numerological at various times. And I suppose in ways they are. But I think it goes back to the fact that even Einstein, you know, saw beauty in the mathematics. And I think scientists see beauty, and you have to see beauty in your work. And sometimes we're rewarded by actual visualizations of it where other people can maybe appreciate what we see. And I think this is a case of that. You know, does it have any practical relevance? Probably not, but it's a beautiful result. And I think that is just as important as a practical one.
And then I guess talking about, you know, really beautiful images, perhaps, in science. This year we had the direct observation of hydrogen orbitals. And I think that's something that a lot of people were talking about. So even though it's not sort of got an official placing on this list, is it worth a mention?
It's worth a mention. I can tell you why it's not on the list. It's not on the list because someone actually did it before.
Okay.
A group was able to directly observe the orbital structure of an excited hydrogen atom, meaning literally look at it, you know, not visualize it in the sense of, oh, taking some math and turning it into some random picture on a computer. This was literally seeing visually. Of course, this brings into question, being that we're FQXI, this brings into question, what does it mean to visualize anyway? Nevertheless, they were able to make it so that you were actually looking at it. So they called it a quantum microscope. The reason it's not on my list is because someone already did it. So it's not that new. About 4 years ago or so, another group did it with a different method. They were not looking at hydrogen, they were looking at carbon. They were using something called field emission electron microscopy, which were basically direct imaging of the intraatomic electron structure in carbon chains. And that's basically the same idea. You're literally looking at the electron structure, so the orbitals, the wave functions. Now, of course, this has some interesting implications for the wave function.
Well, now you mentioned the wave function, and, you know, looking at reports of this in the news, I've seen this reported as the first time we're directly seeing a quantum wave function. So, you know, is that the right terminology to be using here? Is that something we should be getting excited about, whether or not it's the first time?
No.
Right. Okay. Absolutely just to clear that up.
There's still debate about this, but in theory, you can't directly observe a wave function in theory because you would collapse it if you believe in the collapse interpretation. But the point is that, you know, it's not really clear exactly what this quantum microscope is looking at from the standpoint of how do we match that up with the theoretical description. I mean, it's clear that we're looking at the electron structure. But, you know, when we're looking at it, are we really seeing the wave function? Well, we're seeing an orbital, but it's debatable whether we're actually seeing the wave function. This goes back to one of last year's top five, which was the PBR result about whether the wave function is statistical or not. If this really is the wave function that we're seeing, then I suppose the wave function really isn't statistical. But I think the jury's still out on what it is actually that you're looking at. I would hesitate to say, yes, you're looking at the wave function. Yeah, I think more work needs to be done to figure out exactly what they're observing here. But like I said, it's been done before. And again, it also comes down to a subtle question of when we say we're seeing it and looking at it, what does that mean? You know, because when I make observations with a radio telescope, which I've done, I get data that I then turn into a, quote, picture.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Am I really seeing that? You know, am I really seeing what I'm seeing? I'm taking information that's coming via electromagnetic interactions with the telescope, and I'm turning that data and numbers and stuff into a picture that I then absorb in my brain. Does that really mean I'm seeing what's there? I mean, there are some questions that have to be answered about that before I'm willing to say, hey, yes, we're actually seeing the wave function.
That was Ian Durham in his prime. There's more about his top picks of 2013 on the website.
www.fqxi.org/community/podcast. And we'll be revealing Ian's choice of the top physics stories that come in at number 2 and number 1 in the final installment of our December podcast trilogy.
The FQXI Games, Albatross.
Albatross?
The FQXI Games, Mockingjay. I read the first book. I didn't enjoy it.
For now, thank you to Tejinder Verdi and Corinne Pickema.
And to Katniss Durham.
Ian Durham.
She's been Zia Morali.
And he's been Brendan Foster.
At least the Twilight Saga used titles that were related to astronomy.